It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. How and why do we fall for fake news? Like the Russians bribing a member of Congress.
You know, a little over a month ago, I saw a tweet that really captured my attention.
Journalist Zach Beecham.
The Russian government had laundered $10 million to Jason Chaffetz, the chair of the House Oversight Committee, to leak the FBI letter about Hillary Clinton's emails that ended up playing a huge role in the election. This is a crazy claim. There's no evidence for it. There's no reason to believe it. It just struck me because the person who tweeted it wasn't some fringe, unaffiliated, random person's Twitter account. It was a constitutional law expert at Harvard named Lawrence Tribe. He's one of the most well-regarded scholars of the U.S. Constitution alive today. But here he is, broadcasting a clearly false claim.
Congressman Chaffetz.
Connection.
Alcohol.
Strange.
They got nothing.
And so why was that? How did something like that get the attention and command the respect of someone like Larry Tribe?
So how careful are you to make sure you're not falling for and spreading fake news? Zach Beecham is a senior reporter for Vox, and he thinks Russia is in danger of becoming the left's birther movement. Steve Paulson tossed his question right back at him.
Why did Lawrence Tribe do this?
Some people got in touch with him, a journalist at BuzzFeed named Joseph Bernstein, to ask him, and he said that he views his Twitter platform as sort of information agnostic. He just broadcasts something that he thinks is interesting and doesn't really bother to check it out. That strikes me as irresponsible, given the number of Twitter followers he has, which is a lot. More importantly, it's the question of how this claim got to his attention in the first place, right? Like, what flagged it for him? It looks like it came from a website called the Palmer Report, which no one prior to recently had ever heard of because it didn't exist prior to the election. And during the election, it was a little-known pro-Hillary propaganda site, basically just pushing out stories that are favorable to Hillary Clinton, regardless of whether or not they're true. And after the election, it remade itself into a home for low-standard journalism, mostly focusing on stuff critical of Trump and eventually coming to focus on the Russia investigation. You know, it once broadcasted a claim that Trump had a brain condition based on a single tweet from someone who had not actually looked at brain scans from Trump. But it also just got into a little really weird Russia conspiracy theory stuff, like this $10 million. And it actually has gotten really popular. You know, they have 70,000 fans on Facebook. Their stories often get tens and thousands of likes on the platform. The founder, Palmer himself, has tens of thousands of followers on Twitter. It's clear that a community has formed around these poorly sourced ideas. And Palmer himself usually doesn't invent them. He gets them from another source. And that source is something I called the Russiasphere.
Okay, so what is the Russiasphere?
The Russiasphere is a loose network of people, mostly on Twitter, who share ideas about Russia's role in American politics that are almost always quite extreme and hyperbolic. It's a conspiracy theory network. What they do think is that whenever there's a news story, there's a Russian explanation behind it. And they've managed to get a lot of attention by making these claims. And, you know, part of it is that the leader, the most prominent voice in this movement, is a former member of parliament in the UK named Louise Mensch. Louise Mensch is, interestingly, not a liberal or a progressive. She was a Tory MP in the UK. The important part about Mensch is that she's just sort of seized in the past months on any piece of information she could find. When she came over here, she started a conservative website that she ran called Heat Street.
Wait, when she came over here, so she's now in the U.S.?
Yes, she now lives in the United States and has for a few years now.
Okay.
And Heat Street is sort of a standard right-wing website, but in late 2016, it actually got a legitimate scoop. It broke a story that there was an FBI warrant out for communications between the Trump campaign and Russian banks. And she was way ahead of the mainstream media on this story. So, you know, it was a real, real piece of reporting. And that got her some credibility, including an op-ed in the New York Times 5 months after that.
So, I mean, so I guess, so the question, is she a journalist or is she something else?
I guess journalist is probably right. It's just hard to say because no responsible journalist would say things like Sean Hannity and Bernie Sanders are Russian plants, right? And those are the kinds of things
so
that she alleges.
She's saying this and she got an op-ed piece in the New York Times?
Yeah. So she managed to parlay that into some kind of mainstream credibility, but it took a while for the fact that she was spouting really, really ridiculous things on her site, like the fact that there's a racketeering investigation into the entire Republican Party that will bring down Trump, Mike Pence, and Paul Ryan, leading to President Orrin Hatch. Again, real things she says.
But I mean, the thing that's fascinating about Louise Mensch is she has a huge following on Twitter. I mean, it's something like 238,000 people follow her.
283 last time I checked.
283, okay. And then,
it's probably gone up since last time I checked.
Her tweets get picked up by important people. I know the Democratic Senator Ed Markey said something based on something she had tweeted.
Markey's claim was that there were multiple grand jury investigations into Trump. This was not founded in reality, but his aides say that it came from a Palmer Report piece, which was itself citing Louise Mensch. So you get these layers and layers of laundering of weird ideas from the Russia sphere that then somehow creep into mainstream discourse because people either don't bother to check on the quality of the source or they don't care. And not only is it really extreme, it resonates principally with Democrats. So while the people who might be offering the claims aren't all liberals or leftists, their audience is overwhelmingly partisan Democrats.
Are you basically saying this is sort of the left-wing equivalent of, I don't know, Breitbart or
yes.
InfoWars, you know, those very popular sites that traffic in conspiracy on the right?
Absolutely. I would say that Breitbart and InfoWars are precisely the right parallels here. Now, these are much less influential than those sites, so I don't want to overstate the nature of the threat here.
So you're saying there's all this I don't know if disinformation is the right word, but I mean, fake news, you're saying. I mean, stuff that's put out that is a very dubious truth about sort of, you know, Russia's influence in the U.S. I guess it raises the question, what about the Russians? I mean, are they behind this or is this something totally different?
No, so this is what's fascinating about it, right? The Russians are not, as far as I can tell, involved in this. This isn't like a weird double-blind, secret Russian reverse psychology thing to discredit Russia investigations. But it does show how the Russian strategy works, right? This is an unintended but happy consequence from their point of view. The goal of the Russian campaign, in part, is to sow dissension and create a sense of unclarity about what actual facts are. They're better off in a world where Americans don't think they can trust their own government and the information they get from it and from mainstream sources, because then they're more likely to trust the kind of false claim that you do hear from Russia-related propaganda outlets. And Russia has tried this on both the left and the right ideologically. They're just looking for anyone who might believe claims that are friendly to the Kremlin.
But I thought there was a more specific goal, and this is the thing that U.S. intelligence agencies have said, at least running up to the last presidential election, they wanted Hillary Clinton to lose and they wanted Trump to win. They thought he was going to be more Russian-friendly.
Yes, it's true that that Russia wanted Hillary Clinton to lose, right? But they also wanted to, in general, delegitimize and weaken American political institutions. From their point of view, the world is better and freer for them if Western countries are internally divided and fighting over their own issues, that they can't muster a sustained response to Russian foreign policy adventurism. And devolving into conspiracy theories on both sides is exactly the kind of thing the Russians would see as a positive development in that it weakens the consensus on what is true and what needs to be focused on inside American politics.
Okay, so I'm going to give you your hardest assignment of the day here. In
okay,
2 minutes,
okay.
Tell me what is true and what is conspiracy theory regarding Russian influence in American politics.
What we know for a fact is that Russia hacked various different Hillary Clinton allies, and that they laundered those emails through WikiLeaks and other outlets and published them. And the intent of doing that was to sow dissension inside the U.S. and to elect Donald Trump president. We know that. Everything beyond that, we can't quite be sure of yet. It's really all in the realm of speculation, and you have to try to use your judgment on what sounds ridiculous and what doesn't. So the Russians paying $10 million to a U.S. congressman, that's ridiculous, right? That's just not credible. And I mean, and the problem with that test, though, is that there are some things that the U.S. government is taking seriously, like the allegations of Donald Trump being filmed with prostitutes in Russia, mm-hmm. that sound ridiculous. And so you're in this world where the things, your BS detector is uncalibrated. It's been decalibrated by the news. And you have to be careful not to allow it to be so decalibrated that really strange claims like Bernie Sanders is a secret Russian agent don't get through your radar.
And yet, a lot of us, you know, look at what's posted on our Facebook page, what shows up in our Twitter feed, and we want to believe the stuff that, I mean, it, you know, we've been targeted because we have certain beliefs and, you know, who knows if these are half-truths or lies that show up on our feeds. What are we supposed to do with that?
Don't share things on Facebook blindly. If you don't know the source or you're not familiar with them and you read the headline and it sounds crazy, Google their name first. Just take a brief second to check and see if this is considered a credible source or where else they've shown up. And try to be neutral while you're doing that check, right? Try to make sure that you're looking at real sites that are giving you actual information about these other sites, that they're not just validating themselves and describing themselves as being legit and talking about all the places they've been cited, because oftentimes that's cited negatively. Practicing good information hygiene is the way I would put it. It means double-checking your gut reaction. A lot of this comes from the fact that we don't like to scrutinize beliefs that seem friendly to our own ideological system. As you said, you want to believe things that flatter your own ideas, right? And you have to resist that impulse at least a little. The problem is that for a large portion of people, their most trusted sources are willing to pander to the worst ideas. And that is a problem I don't know how to solve.
Zach Beecham is a senior reporter for Global Affairs at Vox. Steve Paulson talked with him. Here's what I want to know. How does all that fake news make its way to my Twitter feed in the first place? I mean, who or what sent it? Filippo Menzer is a professor of computer science and informatics at Indiana University, and he says a lot of that fake news is being spread by bots, which make up somewhere between 9 and 15% of Twitter accounts. Just to bring this down to a real-world example, we now have a president of the United States who is an active, avid Twitter user. How easy would it be for somebody somewhere to create a bot system to feed the president fake news directly to target him?
Well, of course, we have no way of knowing exactly how our president forms his opinions and ideas. However, we do know that he uses Twitter. So it would be reasonable for me to assume that he reads Twitter. And so I could create a bunch of fake accounts that mention the president, retweeting links to fake news. And so that if the president were, or anyone else, by the way, this applies to you and reporters and citizens as well, any influential person. So it would not be difficult to make it so that when you open your Twitter app, you get the impression that a lot of people are telling you, hey, look at this. This is important. This is outrageous. You should check it out. And then if you click on the link, you will see the false report or the misleading report. And in fact, we do observe that this does happen. So there are hundreds of bots that do exactly what I just described to you.
So target the President of the United States' Twitter account?
Yes. of course, if you're in the business of promoting your message, why wouldn't you try to put it in front of the people who have the influence to make it go viral? That is one of the strategies that, of the astroturfing strategies that are done by fake news bots. Either they tweet or retweet with links to fake news article, and they mention an influential target. Or sometimes they will reply to a message by an influential target. So that way the person is likely to see the alert and see, oh, somebody's responding to what I posted. Somebody's saying something to me. They are reacting. And so they might look at it and say, oh, these people are responding to me. They are agreeing with me. And they're sharing this link. Let me see what it is.
Have you been able to trace or identify a specific bot or piece of misinformation or fake news that was targeted deliberately to the president?
I can mention one example. There was fake news about millions of illegal immigrants voting. There was this fake news that it started with some account that has, I think, believe since been taken down on Twitter making this claim. And then this claim was taken and amplified by a bunch of fake news websites and political websites.
And this is a claim the president has repeated many times.
Yes. And in the days prior to that, we have found many bots who have try to put the link to that fake news article in the news feed of the president. So they would just reply to messages, or they would simply tweet messages mentioning the account of the president with the links to the story from, let's say, InfoWars or other such sources.
The danger is that there aren't that many influential people in the world who have the codes for the nuclear football. So do you think, I don't know, should the NSA be screening the president's Twitter feed?
I am not going to comment on that. It goes a little bit too much into the political for my level of comfort. We are trying to analyze the problem and to highlight how social media are being abused. And then we leave it to the public and the policymakers and the citizens and the journalists to analyze our data and make recommendations. But certainly, we could see that there are orchestrated attacks that try to manipulate opinions, and they do target influential users.
Filippo Menzer is a professor of computer science and informatics at Indiana University. And now, as if things weren't scary enough, how about a dangerous idea?
I'm Rob Brotherton. I'm an academic psychologist and author of Suspicious Minds: Why We Believe Conspiracy Theories. My dangerous idea is prudent paranoia. So I was viewing an apartment a couple of years ago, and I got talking with the real estate agent. And when I mentioned that I'm a psychologist and I study conspiracy theories, his face kind of lit up. And he said, I'll tell you why people believe conspiracy theories. They're paranoid. So this is something I hear quite often from different people. Paranoia is one of these psychological terms that's made its way into mainstream wisdom, but it's become almost like a dirty word, and it's often thrown around to dismiss conspiracy theories and the people who believe them. There's an element of truth here when researchers look at belief in conspiracy theories and paranoia. We do find that the more somebody believes conspiracy theories, the more likely they are to be a little bit more paranoid. But my dangerous idea is that paranoia isn't always pathological. Sometimes it's prudent. So the term prudent paranoia, it was coined by a psychologist called Roderick Kramer at Stanford University. And in his research, he found that people in relatively vulnerable positions tend to be a little bit more suspicious of the people around them. And in fact, he's found that prudent paranoia is rampant in the business world, presumably because in business negotiations, people often do have hidden motives. When we scale this idea up to the realm of global politics, I think it's not that surprising that you'll find that people come up with conspiracy theories. We know that politicians and other people in positions of power do sometimes have vested interests. They don't always tell us everything that they're up to. And, you know, you have to look no further than the Watergate affair. There's been the Tuskegee study, in which hundreds of impoverished African-American farmers were enrolled in the study of syphilis without being told that it was a study of syphilis, and the cure was withheld for some of them for many years. So with this idea of prudent paranoia in mind, I think it's not surprising that research shows, for example, African-Americans who know about the Tuskegee study are more likely to believe conspiracy theories like AIDS was created by the government and the crack epidemic was controlled by the government to harm African-American people. Of course, this is not to say that conspiracy theories necessarily have any truth to them. It's a more nuanced idea than that. Just because you're paranoid doesn't necessarily mean they're out to get you, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're not either. So just because we can't trust some people some of the time doesn't mean that we shouldn't trust anyone ever. The point is that writing every conspiracy theory off as paranoid is just as misguided as uncritically accepting every allegation of conspiracy.
So I guess just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
So let me start at the beginning. So my dad was a freedom rider, a civil rights activist in the 60s. When I was about 10 or 11 years old, my father showed me these documents, government released these documents. It was a huge, huge file, newspaper clippings, memos, minutes for meetings. They were describing the car he was driving. They're describing the hotel he stayed at. I mean, it was details about his everyday life. You know, this is the government checking in on my dad. You know, I became sort of less susceptible to, oh, that's just a conspiracy theory, because I saw a conspiracy in action.
How would you react if you found out the FBI had been following your dad? That story's coming up. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. And PRX. When David Dennis was a kid, his father, a civil rights activist, showed him his FBI file. Pages and pages, photos, documents. And that's how David learned that what some people at the time considered a conspiracy theory was, in fact, true. The American government did spy on the Black Liberation Movement. Well, today, David's a journalism professor at the historically black Morehouse College and author of a recent piece called Why Black People Need Conspiracy Theories. Charles Monroe Kane asked him to explain.
You know, I remember in Living Color had a character who was in jail and he was spouting off these theories about the government and, you know, putting drugs in black communities and who really assassinated people. And they were called, you know, they're considered conspiracy theories. And so within black communities, it was like you're embarrassing us if you start spouting out these theories. Right. However, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement, with footage of actual police cover-ups, with footage of black people being killed and it going against what police officers say happened, we're getting an understanding that we need to have a healthy discernment of what's actually being told to us and what actually happened. So these things that used to be called conspiracy theories are not so much conspiracy theories anymore, as much as we need to be more sort of aware of what the possibilities are.
You know, it's interesting. I'm just picturing, like, you know, when you think about conspiracy theories, you always think about the Illuminati, right? A bunch of white guys, cigars, sitting around a table, and they're, like, making nefarious plans. I mean, do you see, like, a bunch of dudes sitting around a table saying, let's put more black people in prisons? Or is it just, like, individual people are racist and this kind of comes out naturally? Because I think there's a big difference.
That's the thing that I always think about. Like, I don't know if there are, you know, these brilliant billionaires scheming and sitting down, like you said, sitting down playing poker, thinking about how to ruin black people's lives, right? But, you know, destroying black communities, violence against black people, marginalizing black people is so ingrained in American culture. That's, you know, been here since America's been here, right?
Right.
So I don't even know if you need to necessarily plan for that together to go to that goal, because that's been a goal of this country since the very beginning.
You know, it brings up just an amazing question for me. And I hear you talking. It's like, is there a difference between systemic oppression and a conspiracy theory?
No, not really. I mean, a conspiracy theory is sort of one of those made up terms at this point, you know, is being used to disregard somebody's actual concerns about something that happened. And this really became clear to me when Sandra Bland was killed, right?
Right.
She was pulled over, she died in police custody, and then they showed a mugshot of her. And there was all of these theories that, you know, she was actually dead in the mugshot and that she had died hours before. They were sort of put as quote-unquote conspiracy theories. And, you know, from what I understand, they were not true. She was alive at the time that the pictures were taken. However, we need to understand that anything is possible when it comes to this. The more we learn, the more we're learning that these things are more possible, that something happened in that jail that led to her death. And the first of all, she shouldn't have been in jail in the first place, right?
Right.
So we knew this. Like, we talk about these things amongst ourselves and we know this, right? And there's been a feeling that you can't repeat these things in mixed company because you look crazy.
I was reading, it was on The Root, their website, and I was looking at the top 10 conspiracy theories for the African-American community. And one of them really, really struck me, and it was from the South. I think it was in Georgia, so I think it's where you are right now, where the KKK was putting poison in soda pop that black men were drinking. Now, this has been disproved numerous times again and again, but still, it's a pervasive belief. What happens when it goes to that level, when it starts to caricature people as, I don't know, I hate to use the word, but as gullible? What do you do with that?
I remember there was a shoe, I forgot what shoe it was, that the KKK was putting these shoes in the black community. I think it was like Adidas or something like that, right? And so, like, there was this was a belief that happened at the time, right? But what happens when these things get proven untrue, then there's a belief, oh, well, none of these conspiracy theories are true, right? But what people need to understand is the reason why we can believe these things happen, right? If you can believe Tuskegee, then there's a belief that the KKK is poisoning sodas for black people. Like, these are based on proof and things that we know actually happen.
You know, you're a journalism professor at a traditionally black college, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you, you know, you got some idealistic student, you know, she, he's 19 years old. They're journalism students, right? They're going to talk to you about truth. What do you say to them?
As a journalist, you have to dig in for, you know, for the truth, right? But also as black people, you come into a story sort of understanding your own truth, right?
Yes.
So I tell them there are two ways to approach a story, right? One is I'm going to find out what happened. I'm going to talk to the people. I'm going to try to understand and, you know, research to get to the bottom of this, right? And the other way to write a story is F you, I'm right. And so that essentially comes from, you know, if I'm doing a story on a personal experience being, you know, followed by police, right? Which I have lots of personal experience with that happening, right? When I write that story, there's going to be a lot of anecdotal evidence from people who say that I'm making that up, right? Or that I'm being fallen victim of my own conspiracy. But I know from 31 years of experience in this country, I know exactly why I'm being followed by police. So F you, I'm right, right?
Right.
And so when you're telling those stories, you can tell them in a way that you understand that there are people who have their own version of the truth that will try to dispel your personal experience, but your experience is your equity when it comes to those stories.
It's funny. It's almost like you can slap conspiracy theory on a label of something to discredit it.
Yeah, that's become the problem. And that's sort of infected the black community because, like I said before, you can't say these things against mixed company. When you're around, you know, white people, when you're at work, you can't say, hey, the war on drugs is a war on black people, right? Or you say the prison industrial complex is about continuing slavery into, you know, the 21st century. Like, it was, there was a stigma around that stuff. And I think part of it is Twitter and social media. Now we have a community of people where you're not only, you're no longer the only black person in the room wherever you go, because you have, you know, these people on social media who have your back. So you can say these things, you know, with a little bit more shortness and pride and information. So, but, you know, that conspiracy theory label is just another way to silence black people, which is something that, you know, this country has mastered the art of trying to silence black people.
It seems like for white people, there's like a difference. The Barack Obama's birth certificate is such a different conspiracy theory than crack was introduced by the CIA in LA in the 1980s. They're like a different idea even.
Right. I mean, Alex Jones got an hour-long NBC special.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, and his, you know, and he's mastered the white conspiracy theory. Quote, you know, like the idea of that Sandy Hook would never happen. And he's been given an hour of airtime on one of the prominent channels in the country. But we don't get that space. We don't get to go on TV and say, this is why drugs are in black communities. We don't get to do those things in the same way that white people with these same theories get.
Yeah, you're not getting your hour with Kelly, are you?
Right, right.
Hey, and if I just met you and we were sitting in a bar or a coffee shop and we were chatting and I asked you if you're a conspiracy theorist, how would you answer that question?
I would say that generally there's really, for black folks, there's no such thing as conspiracy theories, I don't think, because there are so many conspiracies against black people, you know, so there's no such thing. I do believe that there is a history of things going on against black people that we need to investigate. Some of the things I may hold dear, believe to be true, may be wrong, but if they're wrong, there is a reason that I believe them. And there's something along the line that happened to cause me to believe that this is possible. Like, okay, so I'm married, right? I have my wife. And so if I leave the house, right, and if she's always thinking that I'm out cheating or something, a lot of chances are that there was something that I did in the past that leads her to believe that that happened, right?
Right.
So there's something in the history of this country that has allowed us to believe that we are vulnerable and susceptible to this violence from this country, and we need to investigate why we are allowed to believe those things.
David Dennis, he's a professor of journalism at Morehouse College, and Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And now, a story about radium, the glow-in-the-dark element. When it was first discovered around the turn of the century, people fell in love with it. They used it to cure everything from cancer to constipation. They played hit songs, like this one, The Radium Dance. They wore radium bras and radium jock straps. Rich people drank radium water.
It was also seen as this elixir of youth. People took it in the same way that we take vitamins, and the recommended dose was 5 to 7 glasses a day.
What happened to those people?
Many of them died.
When we come back, the story of how radium nearly killed a town, and the women who fought back. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. If you wake up in the middle of the night, you can push a button to see what time it is. But back in the 19-teens and 20s, there was only one way to make a clock glow in the dark, and that was to paint the numbers with radium. It was delicate, finicky work, and radium dial factories hired young women to do it. They were taught to keep their brushes sharp by lip pointing, which basically means sucking on them. Of course, radium is radioactive. The girls got horribly, gruesomely sick, and they began dying. And the companies refused to do anything about it. So the girls fought back in court. Writer Kate Moore tells their story in The Radium Girls. She says she could not stop thinking about them.
I was transfixed by this extraordinary true story of women fighting for their rights. And I was really struck that as the girls are lip pointing, putting their paintbrushes between their lips, and you know they're swallowing radioactive substances, you're reading what they're doing and you're thinking, no, don't do it, in the same way that if you watch a horror movie, you just think, you know, the young blonde heroine as she wanders down that darkened alley and you're thinking, don't do it. You feel the same about these girls.
You described some wonderful scenes. So radium, it's glow in the dark, as we said. It made the girls literally glow and shine. And they loved that.
They did, absolutely. Because they thought it was completely harmless, which is what their managers told them, they themselves would actually use some of that paint as makeup. They put it on their eyelids for eyeshadow. They paint their teeth with it. There was a report.
Why would you want glow-in-the-dark teeth?
I know. It's slightly strange. But they would. And, you know, Catherine Wolfe, one of the Illinois dial painters, talks of how the women would wear their good dresses to the plant because after they finished work, they'd go out in the dance halls and the radium girls would be the ones shining and shimmering with this ethereal glow as they're twirling and dancing to the latest jazz tunes.
I just have to say, there's the headline of one article I read said, still glowing in the coffin. Are they all still glowing in their coffins?
Well, supposedly radium has a half-life of 1,600 years. So it will still be emanating its rays, even as we're speaking here 100 years on.
Who was the first girl to die of radium poisoning and what happened to her?
Her name was Molly Maggia. So it started in Molly in her teeth, which was true of many dial painters. She had a bad tooth that was hurting her, so she went to the dentist and he extracted it. But then her next tooth started to hurt, and then the next one. Even after they took the teeth out, she'd have these ulcers that would seep pus. And so she goes to the dentist, absolutely desperate for some kind of help, for some kind of ease to this excruciating pain that she's suffering. And she indicates to the dentist that it's her jawbone that is hurting. And the dentist reaches into her mouth with his hand and gently probes at her jawbone. And it breaks against his fingers. And he is able to lift it out of her mouth because the radium has destroyed her jawbone. That's her lower jawbone. And a week later, he does the same to the rest of the bone in her mouth. And just to explain what radium does, so it's a bone seeker. Your arm bone, a leg, your hip, your spine, once the radium was inside those bones, it was shooting out those radioactive rays that we know it has. And it was actually making holes in the woman's bones. So when the doctors studied them, they found that they were honeycombed and moth-eaten. And so what Molly Maggio was trying to treat with aspirin was her, you know, her bones were literally having holes drilled in them. Catherine Sharp, one of the radium girls, said that the pain could only be compared to a dentist drilling on a live nerve for minute after minute, hour after hour, for days, weeks, months at a time. That's what she said the pain of being a radium girl was like.
And in the meantime, the girls would go to the companies, and the companies would say no, or they'd say you're imagining it or you're making it up. And they paid doctors to testify against the girls. The level of the cover-up is kind of hard to believe.
It's really quite shocking. As you say, the depth of depravity to which they would sink. They hired private detectives to dig up dirt on these women. They actively lied to them. They concealed medical test results.
There's one, I think you wrote that at one point they tested a lot of the girls for their radium levels. They didn't give the girls the test results, but they themselves created a list of who was going to die first.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened. They graded them depending on how radioactive they were. And so I saw in the archives when I was researching, it's there in black and white, a list of all the women's names and a number next to that name, you know, from 1 through to 5. And 1 is the highest radioactive, you know, radioactivity level you can have. I found them because I'm researching decades on, but the girls themselves that this directly involved were not only not shown those results, they were actually told, you're fine, you know, we've never found any trace of anything approaching radium poisoning. And they've got those results in their possession.
I don't see how somebody could look at a woman, a young woman, and know she's going to be dead in a year and look her in the face and say, you're fine.
And just to cite you an example of just how little they really thought of these women, there's one woman, Mildred Cardo, who died only 6 months after she'd been married. And the firm offered her husband a settlement. They said, if you absolve us of all responsibility, we will give you some money in return for your wife's death. But the sum they offered him was $43.75.
Oh, my God.
That just says it all to me. Less than $50 for a human life.
Kate, I can't imagine your own emotional trajectory, what it must have been like doing this research. As you said, finding a sheet of paper with the girl's death dates written down as a kind of corporate calculus. You know, or later, I know you found many of the girls' original letters that they had written to each other. What was this like for you?
Incredibly emotional. I still get incredibly impassioned about it even now. And I actually wrote with pictures of the girls around my desk.
Can you pick one of your favorite young women to tell us about? Just introduce us and, yeah, tell us about her.
Okay, well, it's very hard to pick just one, of course. But I will pick Catherine Wolfe Donohue, who was one of the Illinois dial painters. She was Ottawa-born and bred, so she grew up in the town in Illinois where the dial painting studio opened in 1922. Catherine was 19 when she started work there, and it was her first job. And she worked there for 9 years. She was actually fired for being sick. She had a limp, basically, because the radium had settled in her leg. And they said her limping was causing talk. You've given 9 years of your life to a company and they fire you for being sick, but they've caused the sickness. That was a very big mistake, because what Catherine Donohue did was that she fought back. And it takes years. So by the time that Illinois women are filing suit, it's the Great Depression. And so the town turn against her and the women are disbelieved. They're shunned. They're told they're liars and frauds and cheats. And the families I spoke to when I was interviewing the families for the book, they certainly believed that there was a cover-up in the town. There were 41 lawyers listed in the town directory at the time Catherine was trying to file suit. Not one of them took the case. Mm-hmm. She had to go to Chicago to get a lawyer, Leonard Grossman. And by the time the case comes to court, Catherine is incredibly sick. She has a sarcoma, a bone tumour on her hip caused by the radium, and it's the size of a grapefruit. The doctors talk about her white blood cell count, which should be around 8,000, and she's only got a few hundred. So she's incredibly weak, incredibly frail. Her teeth are falling out. Her jawbone is crumbling in her mouth. She is close to death. And yet Catherine gives evidence on her deathbed. She's too ill to actually physically go to court. So the court comes to her, and in her sitting room on East Superior Street in Ottawa, Catherine lies on her couch with a blanket over her, and she gives evidence in a weak, faltering voice. She can barely open her eyes even as she's giving her testimony. And it's too late for her. Radium poisoning is fatal. She knows she is going to die, but she does it for her friends, and she does it for her family, for her children, for her husband. And I just think that is just a shining example of what these women did. You know, as you say, their bodies were crumbling, they were impoverished, they were facing certain death, they were grieving from the friends they'd lost, and yet they stood up, they fought for their rights.
Wow. They did win in the end. The Supreme Court did finally rule against the company. What happened next? What happened to the company and to the remaining girls?
Unfortunately, yes, they did win. It was ultimately largely a moral victory. There was basically only a pot of money of $10,000 for the women to split between them. But this case, the Radium Girls case, was a landmark case. It was one of the first cases in which an employer was found responsible for the health of its employees. And along the way of the Radium Girls fight, they were changing laws. Hundreds, thousands, millions of other workers were protected. And so I hope what the Radium Girls book does is to give these women a voice, and that showcases that it isn't just a heartbreaking story. It is actually a story of courage and of strength.
Kate Moore. Her book is called The Radium Girls, The Dark Story of America's Shining Women. So I don't know why, but this story really stayed with me. I just couldn't stop thinking about those girls. Maybe out of some kind of identification or empathy. I think every woman has had the experience at some point of feeling like their personal reality is being dismissed by some kind of authority figure. Somehow I just felt like this story was not done. And that turns out to be true, which is how I wound up standing in a graveyard in Ottawa, Illinois, with the descendants of two of the Radium Girls.
My name is Darlene Holm, and my aunt was Margaret Looney. My mother and her sisters called her Peg.
My name is Kathleen Kofoid, and my great aunt was Catherine Donahue.
It's a perfect summer day. The cemetery is a little ways out of town, on top of a hill. There's a guy on a riding mower keeping things neat, and some simple, unremarkable gravestones.
Lot, this is my grandfather, grandmother. This is Peg.
1904 to 1929.
Yes, spent a lot of time here. As a child, we would come, we would bring flowers, and remember coming here with my mother and my aunts. My sister and I would run around.
And what was it you were telling me about underneath this stone, she's buried in a lead-lined coffin?
Yes, yes. When they exhumed her, they took her to Argonne National Lab, and when they brought her back, she is in a lead-lined coffin, although one of my aunts, she always thought that they never returned the body.
So there may be a lot of radioactive bodies here in this cemetery.
I'm sure there are. There was a gentleman, his name was Ken. He used to have a Geiger counter, and he would walk around the cemetery, and he could tell where each of the dial painters were buried because the Geiger counter would go off. And it's so peaceful here, and it's so pretty, and no one would think.
Ottawa, Illinois is a pretty town of about 18,000. It's got a leafy main square, site of the first Lincoln-Douglas debate. Most of the radium dial painters lived their whole lives within these few square blocks. They went to school and church here. The radium dial factory shut down in 1936, but the building itself, contaminated and radioactive, stood here for decades.
Well, see, I lived down the alley from the radium dial. And down in the basement where they had stored the radium, they actually put a meat locker down there. Many people bought meat from the meat locker. And I can go around the neighborhood to families that lived in each and every house. And at least one of my friend's parents, if not both of them, died of cancer. They did tear down the original radium dial in 1969. I was in high school, and I would come home from school, and the dust from the building would have seeped into my parents' home. It would be on the windowsills. We would have to vacuum. We would have to wipe everything down. Then after that, when both of my parents die of cancer and I see other people in the neighborhood and they are dying of cancer, it really makes me wonder, how could it not?
And guess what they did with the radioactive rubble?
They used it as fill. They dumped it all over town.
Wait, they just took all the remains of the building, which would have had a lot of radium.
Yes.
There's probably elements of that building not only buried all over town, but people might still have souvenirs.
Here's another thing I find unbelievable. While the Radium Girls were dying, the factory owner closed up shop, moved three blocks away, and opened up again, but under a different name, Luminous Processes. They used a slightly different painting technique, but the radium was everywhere. On workers' clothes, shoes, fingers. They got cancer at twice the national rate. And yet, the factory stayed open until 1978. When the EPA moved in, there were radioactive hotspots all over town. Ottawa, Illinois became a Superfund site.
You know, when I was a kid, we lived up on the north side, and where some of the areas that they dumped the waste when your neighborhood friends' houses are getting dug around with guys in spacesuits, basically, is what you thought when you were a kid. You know, they're digging up the whole neighborhood, but they're saying, oh, it's fine. You can just still live there in the house while your whole yard and everything is going away. And so a lot of kids through the years, because of playing and all that, they all had ill effects from it, too.
How many people in town do you think know this whole history?
A lot of people don't. Yes. There are a lot of local people, a lot of people that I've talked to in Ottawa, and I got a lot of comments from people. They did not know the story. They had lived here their entire lives.
No, people don't talk about it.
There are a few signs that that may be changing, though. A new brewery opened up recently, founded by four local guys who named it Radium City Brewing, in honor of the Dial Painters. And there's a new statue in town with a fountain.
It represents a radium girl. There was a girl from Mendota that had done a history project on the Radium Dial Girls. She actually spearheaded that we needed a monument. And so the city worked with her. The city worked with her, and they decided to put the monument here, kind of an out-of-the-way spot.
But yeah, I bring my kids down here and whomever else visits, because it's important that they know. It's not just our family history. They should know what happened to women, you know?
Do you feel betrayed?
That's kind of funny. I don't know if I feel betrayed. I think they betrayed the whole community. I think they betrayed the trust of women. I think they betrayed the future of our community, because it's still here and it's still a problem. That's why I find it frustrating that the city is allowing people to build, because it's the same foundation. There's a new business going in right next door. They want to build a family business that's going to serve ice cream to the community. There's no way that I would allow anybody I know to go there and purchase anything.
Kathleen Kofoid and Darlene Halm were born, raised, and still live in Ottawa, Illinois. They're descendants of two of the original Radium Girls. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from the whole staff, including, for the last time, Raymond Tungekar. He leaves us this week for a new job at American Public Media. Raymond's a great journalist, a gifted editor, and an incredibly kind colleague. We wish him everything good and can't wait to hear what he does next. I'm Anne Strange Champs. Till next time.